Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. We've got a really interesting one for you today. Chris, hello.
Hello, you're right.
Who have you found for today?
Well, this one's very different from the last one we recorded. There's no boats in this one. We have Robert Jones, who is a historian who specialises not only in military medieval history, but the social socio-cultural history of those conflicts as well. His previous works have included A Cultural History of the Medieval Sword Power, Piety and Play, and Bloody Banners, Martial Display on the Medieval Battlefield. Robert, welcome to History Hack.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is going to be really interesting. There's no way I'm getting through this without mentioning air warfare and notions of chivalry. Just to make our guest panic right from the off. So I think probably people have an idea of what they think chivalry is, but you argue it's a lot more complicated.
Yeah, I suppose the sort of modern interpretation is a very sort of straightforward one. It's standing up when a lady walks into the room. It's opening a door for her. It's all of the politeness of being a gentleman. And that tends to be the bit of medieval chivalry that often gets remembered, or very often has been. But in fact, medieval chivalry is much more than just polite manners, good manners. It's, in fact, that's the last bit of it really to come. It sort of develops in three ways. So the first sort of core principle is very much the warrior ethic, the idea about being strong and powerful and good at fighting and brave. And then that's something I think which is common to a lot of warrior cultures, and many of those facets you'll find whether you're looking at sort of medieval Europe or ancient Europe or Africa or America or whatever, or even the modern world, those are very similar. What makes chivalry slightly different is what comes through in the High Middle Ages, so in the sort of 12th and 13th century, when the church gets involved and Christian ideals about being charitable, about being merciful, and ideas of piety get interwoven with that military ethic to combine to produce, particularly by the end of the 11th century, beginning of the 12th century, the rise of the Crusades, something which is a fusion of both military and religious. And then, to really kind of confuse things and wrap things together, there's a third element, which is an idea of courtesy, which is courtliness. So that is the element of being able to sort of look after ladies and to behave correctly in polite company. But it's an element there of not only sort of polite behavior, but also of largesse, of being free with what you have. So showing off your wealth through conspicuous consumption, through giving. So you have a real mishmash of elements within this sort of cultural thing of chivalry, which includes politeness, which includes good manners, which includes piety and being merciful, but also has a core running through it of being violent and aggressive and competitive. And I think what's fascinating about medieval chivalry is the way in which those different aspects sort of intertwine, support each other but contradict each other as well. And I think medieval chivalry and medieval knighthood is very much something of a contradiction, which is really can be really difficult to sort of unpick.
How does it affect sort of the medieval view of masculinity?
Hugely. So medieval masculinities are sort of, there's a multitude of them in the same way that there is today. So there are different sort of behaviors expected of men depending on their position within society. But the dominant, the one that comes through very dominantly because of the fact that the knightly class, the chivalric class, are also the ruling class for the most part. There are churchmen involved, and might come to those in a moment because they do sort of fit in. But what it means is that chivalry provides a series of behaviors that shapes the expected norms of male behavior, male society. And at the core of those, again, is this idea, the core of this is the idea about being powerful, about being strong, about being the best at what you do. The phrase often used is, of a most chivalric knight, is that they are prudent. They are a proud man. They are the primary man. They are they show excellence in everything they do. And the major part of what they do, because the raison d'etre of the chivalric elite is war, is fighting. So what they do very well is they fight very well. Whether that's they're very brave, they handle their weapons well, they are successful in combat, all of those elements are there. Now, that's fine. But the problem with that is you need to be seen to be a prudent. You have to have the acceptance of your peers. Which means you have to do deeds of great valor, of great violence, of great time. So there's a sense that if you are born into this chivalric elite, you're born into this noble elite, that you will be a warrior. And if you're a warrior, you have to be seen to be a warrior. So you have to be physically active and you have to be engaged in war. And so your position within society and the view of society towards you is shaped by that. So there is this kind of very core element about being aggressive, about being masculine, about being physical, which runs through not only within the lives of real knights, but also shapes all of the literature of masculine culture in the medieval period as well, tends towards that sense of being a physical man, about being a powerful man. So all of the elements about pride and power and physical acceptance go through into people like Roland, the great epic hero of France, or Arthur and his knights, or any one of a number, Gawain, or a Guy of Warwick, or any one of a number of other chivalric sort of literary heroes. Throughout those stories, there are constant references to them being able to perform great deeds of valor, great deeds of war and power. But, as I say, this is chivalric behaviours, and chivalry as a cultural element has other elements running through it as well. So alongside this idea about them being very powerful, about them needing to show how much of a great warrior they are also being told that they need to be tempered with kindness, with piety. And so there's a strong element within a lot of the chivalric literature about them being very pious people, about the need to show great Christian charity, to show care and affection for those less fortunate, those who are unable to protect themselves, to show measure in what they do so that they are not just bloodthirsty maniacs, although there is an element of that, but also that they are tailoring that bloodthirstiness, that show of prowess, to fit within some accepted norms and others, and perhaps we can, the ideas about protecting the innocent, that sort of thing. It gets really messy in the later Middle Ages when knights start comparing themselves to the monastic communities and to the churchmen, who have a very different sense of masculinity. So a churchman's masculinity is based very much in his piety. And within the monastic community, very often in the way in which they suffer for Christ. So they suffer for their religion by taking themselves out of regular life. They enclose themselves within the walls of a monastery. They fast. They get up and pray throughout the day. All of this sort of thing in praise of God. And that is a masculine thing to do within the context of the monastic communities. The knights start looking at that and going, well, we're a bit like that. We suffer too, but we suffer by being, you know, putting ourselves into battle situations, by risking our lives. And so our piety, our masculinity in that way is very similar to, it's kind of related to the masculinity of the monastic orders, which is a really odd thing. And so it's sort of, there's a constant sort of friction between the military element and the pious element of knightliness, all of which then comes up against the realities of life and the realities of combat. So there are knights who never see battle. So how do you establish your masculinity if you never have the chance to take the battlefield? Or where the realities of combat, the realities of war mean that you don't end up doing great deeds of valor. So how does that work as well? And so there's a lot of navel gazing in late medieval chivalric writing about what are the limits, what does it mean to be a prudhomme, is it just about warfare, are there other ways of understanding their masculinity? So again, it gets really complicated, but at the underneath it is this sort of sense, and it's still very strong, this sense of hypermasculinity, the sense about being, you know, a chivalric hero, about being a military figure and very powerful.
Yeah, I'm having, as soon as you started talking, I had this massive flashback 20 years to a lecture I had at uni from Michael Hicks about the different types of chivalry and about how pervasive it was and how it's all up to interpretation.
Mm-hmm. And, yep, like most history, yeah. Yeah, it is, yeah, really, it gets increasingly tricky the deeper you delve into it.
Yeah, but how do the ideals of chivalry sort of translate to the battlefield?
The battlefield is really where that sort of core element of chivalry is able to show itself. One of the great writers of chivalric literature, in terms of a knight who thinks about chivalry, is a man called Geoffrey de Charny, a French nobleman and knight, and he writes a series of, well, they're answers to questions that don't get asked. It's a really odd little thing that he's producing, but it's effectively what it means to be chivalric and what it means to be a knight. And he says, well, if you're going to be a knight and show yourself to be chivalric, the first thing you could do, you can go and do tournaments. You can go and play at war, and there's honor in that. But better if you can go to war itself and fight in battles. That shows you enables you to show even more prowess, even more honor, even more chivalric virtue. Best of all, if you can go on crusade, because there not only are you showing power, virtue, ability, but you're also doing it in God's name. And that then adds into that pious element of chivalry. So those three elements all sort of interact. But there's this idea that going onto the battlefield is where you show yourself to be chivalric, where you can show off your prowess. And so when you get to the battlefield, what that means is there's often a push for men to go to the field. So you do, particularly when a country is militarily strong, then there is a greater chance of more men going to war. But even not, men will go to war because it is part of their duty. So we often think of knights as being sort of, well, all they do is fight. Knights are born warriors. They spend all their time in a saddle. They're constantly training for war and they're constantly fighting. There are men like that. So there are men with that kind of reputation. Men like Geoffrey de Charny. There's another French knight called Marshal Boucicault. He's quite famous. He appears a lot in discussions of knightly behavior because his biographer tells us that he was a man who would run a mile a day in his armor. He could vault into his horse from a standing jump. He could shimmy up the undersides of ladders. He's a great military figure, and all he seems to do is prepare for war and then fight. It's not quite true, but that's that sort of figure. So there are figures like that for whom war is everything and who are what you consider professional warriors. But then there are men who, for whom that's just an occasional thing. They go to war when their lord, when the king or when their lord requires it. But actually, most of their time is spent doing administrative jobs. So they're all invariably landholders, and that land he's looking after and things like that. So some of these men who go to war have not had much practice as knights. And then there are some that are kind of a bit like sort of, I suppose, a bit like footballers going off for a weekend kickabout, you know, the kind of guy who goes out on a Saturday night, plays by the side. Yet they've got no real practice, and they, you know, if the weather's bad, they don't bother. But when push comes to shove, they feel they ought to go and play because that's what's expected of them in society. And there are groups of knights we see that actually take the field, never having taken the field before. So we get references to men hiring or renting their armor for the duration of a campaign, which does not suggest someone who's a professional. But this drive to show yourself to be a knight, to show yourself on the battlefield, really is important. So that manifests in a number of ways. So that manifests in the deeds they do. So there's this push to show yourself, your individual prowess, this push to be seen to be doing great deeds. That can lead you to do really stupid things, or what perceived by us with a sort of modern cultural context of what warfare is about to be a stupid thing. So a couple of examples. There's the example of William Marmion appears in something called Scarlet Chronica, written by a knight called Thomas Grey. William Marmion is a Lincolnshire knight. And one evening during a great feast, his intended, not his wife, his intended, presents him with a gilded helmet, telling him he should take it to the most dangerous place in the realm and do a great deal of chivalry whilst wearing it. Now, if you're cynic, you'd say she's trying to get rid of him, frankly. But what he does is he rides off and he goes to a place called Nora, which is up on the Scots borders. And this is 14th century, so where England and Scotland are at war. And he arrives at Norham Castle, and he becomes part of the garrison there. And in due course, the Scots arrive, and they stand outside the castle. And he turns to the garrison commander, a man called Thomas Grey, and says, look, this is my opportunity to do this great deed of chivalry. And the garrison commander goes, yes, but you must do it on horseback, because all great deeds of chivalry are done mounted, not on foot. So this guy puts the gilded helmet on his head, gets on his horse, rides out through the gates against the Scots single-handed. And he drives them back, presumably because they're all wondering what this idiot is up to. But eventually they overwhelm him and they drag him to the ground and they strike him around the head, at which point Grey and the rest of the garrison ride out and rescue him and then drive the Scots off. But the fact that the military commander is willing to let him do this kind of one-off lone ride against the Scots and then is willing to risk his garrison and his castle by taking on the Scots army to rescue this one man is kind of indicative of the sort of elements of way in which chivalry can get involved. There's another example as well, which is another famous one. The Battle of Crecy is John of Bohemia. So John of Bohemia, King of Bohemia, is with the French army at Crecy in 1346. He's gone blind. He's in his 40s, but he went blind in his 30s. But he's riding, leading his men to the engagement. And he hears that his son is involved in the battle. So his son is already in the front line fighting the English and is hard pressed. So he turns to his supporters, his retainers, and says that they should lead him into the engagement so he can strike at least a single blow against the English. And they do. And Froissart, who's the great French chronicler, tells us this story. He says that once the battle is over and the English are victorious and the French are routed, on the field, John is found dead with all of his retainers who had strung themselves together. They basically tied their horses together to ride, lead him into battle, despite the fact that he was completely blind. And again, this sort of bizarre, illogical behavior is there because of this drive of chivalric expectation, this drive to show yourself to be a prudhomme, to show yourself to be a physical and active medieval warrior.
So mentioning Crecy and, of course, Agincourt, French nobles weren't particularly happy with the English because we had a tendency to let our peasants, who are obviously not trained knights or chivalric warriors, rain down longbow arrows into the and kill off the nobility.
Sort of. I think we tend, that's a narrative that tends to come about in later years because we of this sort of there's a sort of English nationalistic thing about the English archer and the English longbow. And I think some of that element of it being the peasant, longbowmen overwhelming the English aristocracy is a little bit of the myth. It is true that the French nobility and actually the English nobility as well, nobility in general, looks down on those who are below them, and common knights. So they do have this habit of looking down on the commoners. The French, it causes the French problems in a number of occasions. It does cause a problem at Crecy, but not because of the longbowmen, less so than, we find French knights riding down their own crossbows, their own crossbowmen, because their crossbowmen are getting in the way of a great victory. And then, so this sort of elite, snobbishness about the ordinary ranks, the ordinary classes is quite an interesting one. They do fall foul of Flemish militias. So townsmen, urban militiamen in what is now sort of Belgium, where a couple of times the French get quite badly defeated. So the famous example of that is the Battle of the Golden Spurs at Courtrai, where a French royal army is soundly defeated by an urban militia made up of ordinary working class folk protecting their city against the French. And it's known as the Battle of the Golden Spurs because so many French knights were killed in that fight that the Flemish collected up the spurs and placed them in their cathedral as a kind of token of their victory at the end of it. One of the ways in which the things do change is that for the English knights, there is a sort of slightly more pragmatic view in some ways, or it appears to be more pragmatic, because there's a tendency to get off their horse and fight on foot alongside their archers. So there's more integration perhaps between the non-chivalric archer and then the chivalric knight in English armies. But that's born out of necessity, because the English just do not have enough knights and men-at-arms to be able to oppose the numbers that the French are putting in the field. And so to be victorious, English kings have to find a different set of tactics. And that means relying on archery and massed archery to kind of even the odds, if you like, on the battlefield. And I think that's where there's a greater difference.
Yeah. I know it's a bit silly, but I could just hear Worf from Star Trek saying there is no greater honor than victory. And so with the English, it's that kind of, well, our knights will fight on foot, but we still win. Or in this occasion, we're going to win, and that's chivalric and honourable in its own way. We don't have to.
It is.
As long as you win, you're by the rules.
Yeah. And medieval chivalry is a very much a pragmatic thing as well. So yes, there are these ideals about behaviour and ideals about the way in which you can gain the most honour. But equally, there's a very pragmatic streak in all chivalric figures, not just the English. I mean, the French quite happily dismount and fight on foot as well in a number of engagements. It's just that very often they don't feel the need to because they feel they have overwhelming superiority, and very often do. The French win far more battles than, you know, we mentioned Crecy, Poitiers, Agincourt as the great three victories of the Hundred Years' War. Whatever, plenty more French victories, and there's a very good reason why the King of England, Charles III, is not King of France. So but that pragmatism is quite central as well. So it's perhaps very easy to get caught up in the sort of chivalric expectations and assume that these knights are just fools and idiots. They're not. Their decisions are made about pragmatic reasons as well as for chivalric expectation and sort of performative elements.
Yeah, you're not going to fight a battle that you're going to lose just because you're following a preset of rules.
Generally, yes. Generally, you will. And sometimes the requirements will force you into it. So there's a suجestion that the Battle of Bannockburn and the campaign that leads to the Scots' victory at Bannockburn, it comes about because Richard II feels that he is expected to relieve an English garrison. So there's a negotiation between the Scots and the English garrison. The English garrison say if they're not relieved by a certain date, they'll surrender the castle. And Richard feels he is obliged to do so. So I think, and I'm talking off the top of my head on this one, but I think there is an element of obligation there, which is chivalric, but is also royalist idea that you protect your own, that forces him into places. And there are a couple of other occasions where yeah, the sort of drive to be chivalric, the drive to do the great deed, again, just leads them away from doing the sensible thing. But that's not peculiar to medieval warriors or medieval soldiers. There are plenty of other occasions where sort of the hubris of a commander or the sort of political requirements or social cultural requirements push people into making decisions which don't follow military logic.
Absolutely. And if you fail to relieve a garrison, that becomes a stick on which you are beaten for years after. The examples of the later ones that come to mind are General Webb not marching to relieve Fort William Henry during the Seven-Year War, and then Clinton not marching to Burgoyne or Cornwallis, to relieve either Cornwallis or Burgoyne in 77 and 81. But I said they're well out of the period. That's what they're always remembered for. But yeah, moving on. There were really complicated rules about prisoners, wasn't there?
Yeah, so alongside this desire to do great deeds of chivalric virtue, alongside this need to be shown to be proved on to be a great military man, to be a great warrior, there's an element of restraint, as I said. There's an element by which the chivalric elite becomes a sort of pan-European elite. So partly because most of these families are interlinked in some way. So certainly the nobility of England and the nobility of France have common ancestors. So there are a number of families which have branches on either side of the channel. And even after sort of King John loses the Norman lands and families have to make decisions about which king they follow, a lot of them still sort of, the families sort of split the branches up. So there'll be a branch in England, a branch in France, and there'll be similarities. There are also cultural similarities, and they kind of tie them together as well. So, you know, amongst the Western European knightly elite, there's a common recognition of brotherhood. And what that means is that there's an element by which you try not to kill other members of that knightly brotherhood, of that chivalric elite, to the extent that Brainiol, in 1119, so this is during the wars between the King of France and the King of England, Henry I. There's a battle fought between Norman knights and French knights, so Anglo-Norman knights and French knights. And our chronicler, who is a man called Audric Vitalis, tells us that in that battle there were 900 knights, but by the end only 3 knights had been killed. And he says this was partly because they were all clad in mail, so they were all clad in armor, but also because they showed restraint out of Christian charity and a sense of military brotherhood. So this idea that they were all part of one sort of chivalric elite and chivalric family restrained them from killing each other. Again, part of that is that ideal, but also part of it is very pragmatic. So these men are worth money. And if you can capture them, you can ransom them back to their families. So you can arrange basically payment to release them. And so what develops from this sort of 11th century, 12th century period right through into the 14th century is an increasingly sophisticated system whereby if you get captured on the battlefield, you would be led away and you would negotiate a ransom, which you would pay and then become released. Or indeed, you would get released to go and collect your ransom. So Geoffrey de Charny, who I mentioned before, the chivalric writer, he's captured by one of the Talbot family, one of the earls of Shrewsbury in the 1340s. And he's brought across from France. He's brought to Goodrich Castle in Herefordshire, where he negotiates a ransom. Once the negotiations are completed, de Charny is released and returns to France to raise the money. So this sense that you can trust someone to go and raise money for their own ransom and they can be allowed their own recognizance is quite interesting. De Charny has a bit of a problem. He's a little short of cash. And his friends to whom he turns for money, they appear to be a bit short of cash as well. And the next thing we hear of de Charny, he's actually gone abroad. He's actually gone on crusade. And I wonder whether part of the reason he went on crusade is because it gave him legal protection whilst he was away doing God's work, as it were, which meant that Talbot couldn't sort of approach the King of France to say this man's defaulted on his ransom and question this man's honour, question de Charny's honour. So that might be something interesting. But clearly he comes back, he does pay up. It's quite interesting to try and work out how that works on the battlefield, though. So whilst you're hitting someone over the head with a pole axe or a sword or anything, at what point do you kind of stop and say, do you want to surrender now? There's a really interesting kind of, it says a lot about the nature of combat on the battlefield, that these men can sort of wail on each other and yet survive long enough to be able to turn around and go, do you know what? I surrender. I stop. It happens very frequently. Sometimes it's quite complicated, and it's clear that there are a number of occasions where we find medieval court cases going on because two or three men claim to have captured the same knight and are therefore due the ransom money, and a court has to decide how much is due to which men, and it depends on who took him first or if the man if he's fighting on the battlefield, surrenders, and Knight A takes the surrender and has one of his men lead this captive off the field. And then that captive is found alone and is captured by another knight. Knight B also gets a claim to it, and then the courts have to sort it out, and it gets really complicated. To the point at which we find there are rules set in advance about how ransoms will be divided up. And some of that's about sort of stopping all of this squabbling. Some of it's also actually that the kings realise that they can actually make a pretty penny out of this. So under Richard II and Henry V, we find rules for ransoming which say, right, when you ransom a captive, the really big names, so princes of the realm, that sort of thing, they come straight to us. They're our prisoners. And there's a political element to that. But when it comes to other men, the ransom money will be split, and it will be split three ways. A third will come to the crown. So it comes straight into royal revenues. A third will go to the man who did the capturing, and then a third goes to that man's lord. So that means that those ordinary archers that you referred to had an opportunity there to make it rich. Because if they captured a great nobleman, he would be taken back as a prisoner, but they would do a third of his ransom money. And there are tales of English archers, particularly after something like Crecy or Poitiers or Agincourt, where a large number of French nobles are taken, making a pretty penny and making themselves quite wealthy out of ransom money. Doesn't always work. There are some occasions where you don't want men to be ransomed because they're too powerful. So one prime example is the capture of Bertrand de Guesclin. He's a leading figure in the French military. He's a commander of the king's forces in a proxy war that's taking place in Castile in Spain. And he's captured by the Black Prince, and the Black Prince refuses to ransom him. And what de Charny does is he goads the Black Prince. So he's kept perfectly well. He's looked after as a knight should, and he's fed and he's watered, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually he says, the Black Prince asks him one day how he's doing. He says, I'm doing okay, but words got out that you won't ransom me. And the Black Prince was, no. He says, well, words going out that you won't ransom me because you're frightened. And all the French nobles and many other people in Europe think that you, the Black Prince, are too frightened to ransom me, Geoffrey de Charny, because I'm too much of a threat. At which point the Black Prince loses his rag and says, no, don't be daft. I'm happy to. If you were prepared to pay 100,000 francs, you can go today. At which point, the Glasgow says, that's brilliant. Fine. In that case, I'll pay the money. Off I go. And the Black Prince is his father tells him off. Edward III turns around and says, well, that was a stupid thing to do because now he's released. He's free. He can go back into battle and we'll have to fight him again. And sure enough, that's what they end up doing. So there are examples where ransoms get really complicated and tricky to deal with. But it's a fascinating element of what should be a really bloodthirsty, bloody battle. We're expecting to see people being hacked in half and things because that's what the chivalric tales tell us happen. But alongside that, you've got very clear examples where knights are surviving battles quite happily or being ransomed or being captured. So again, it's one of those contradictions of chivalric warfare that you have extreme violence alongside extreme pragmatism and a preparedness to kind of show mercy.
any examples of a knight attempting to surrender, saying, all right, yeah, no, you've hit me around the head enough, I'm done, and his combatant saying, no.
There are a few. They tend to be quite unusual. There are occasions where they're not, people are not recognised. So Gilbert de Clare, the Earl of Gloucester, he dies on the battlefield at Bannockburn, and one of the stories around that, or one of the sources, suggests that the reason that he was killed was because he got, and again, this is a very chivalric story, he gets into a squabble with the Earl of Hereford over who should lead the army. They both have a family right to take the lead. And during the course of the conversation, this is the night before the battle, the Earl of Hereford accuses de Clare of cowardice. So de Clare says, well, that's I'm not a coward and I'll prove it. And gets up first thing in the morning, is in such a rush to take the field that he neglects to put on his heraldry. And so rides into battle in bare armour. The Scots don't recognise him for who he is. And so during the fight, they don't even try and they just kill him as being a man of no great consequence. Whereas if they had recognised him by his heraldry, then they might have protected him. So that's one of the ways in which you see men dying, even though they should have been ransomed. During the Hundred Years' War, we get plenty of men who are, they're noble, they're chivalric, but their status isn't quite high enough. And there are a number of sort of brigands that arise during the period of the Hundred Years' War, where they've established themselves and their retinue in a castle, and they are raiding the land around, and they're causing all sorts of problems. And the French become quite hard and quite harsh in their punishment of these men, and they get taken and they get executed without being given the benefit of ransom. So that happens. And then the third example is the Wars of the Roses. So during that 15th century conflict, there are a number of internal sort of family feuds that build up where, because of what you did to my uncle or my cousin or my brother or my father, I'm not going to ransom you. And in fact, you get taken and you get, and so executions become much more bloody during that period. But again, that's not so much about chivalry not working, but more about the political realpolitik being far more important.
Yeah, I mean, you only have to look at the Battle of Tewkesbury, where at the end the survivors from the House of Lancaster flee to the monastery and get dragged out and executed. But the real example I can think of is Henry Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, who leaves Henry VI's army, goes to Edward IV. Edward rehabilitates him, but after a period of time, he returns back to Henry VI's army. When he gets captured after the Battle of Hexham, just gets taken out, there's no chance of ransom or rehabilitation. It's straight to the block. You've had your shot.
Yeah, yeah. And that's interesting, isn't it? That chivalry is about honour and about loyalty. Or we perceive it very much as about honour and about loyalty, but actually realpolitik says that you can switch sides. That's not seen as wrong, of course, until you pick the wrong side. At which point, yeah, your head's on the block and that's it. The other example, the famous example, of course, of ransoms not being taken is Agincourt, where Henry V orders the execution of noble prisoners during the course of the battle. And sometimes a modern audience has often said, well, this is a terribly unchivalric thing to do. What a butcher he is. But actually, again, this is an element of pragmatism. So at the point at which Henry orders this execution, he is right on the verge of being defeated. He's worried about a third force of French coming round into his rear and attacking, at which point all of these noble prisoners who are hanging around the back of the English lines with nothing but their honour to stop them from picking up swords and taking up the fight again, they become a threat. And so he has to respond to that threat. And so his response is to have them all killed, or at least they start killing them until it's clear that actually that threat is gone, at which point the order is rescinded, which is why not every single one of them goes. But that's one of those occasions where, yes, the chivalric ideal is that you should all, you should take prisoners, you shouldn't kill your opponent, you should recognize them and honor them. But actually what happens is that the realities of war take over, and it's like, well, actually, if we leave them alive, then we're going to lose this battle. So we have to be more pragmatic about it.
So without sounding like a Marxist, was chivalry reserved for your class equal, so noble to noble, knight to knight. It doesn't really count for, without quoting Blackadder, for the arrow fodder, you know, all the peasants. Do they count in this for surrendering and chivalry? Although, now I've got that whole thing from Blackadder in my head of, you're not going to put him anywhere near me, are you?
Yes, there's an element of that. So, chivalry is the sort of culture of the martial elite. And so that word elite is there very, very strictly. Over time, that the people that are incorporated in that sort of, it expands, then it contracts, and then it expands again. So in the early years of chivalry and the rise of knights and knighthood, it's, knights are very much a martial retainer. But as that military ethic that they have gets incorporated into the aristocracy, the noblemen, then so it expands slightly so that there are a few more people. But then with that establishment as part of an elite, part of an aristocratic and landholding elite, the idea is to kind of restrict access. And one of the ways in which you do that is to make sure that you restrict the culture as well. So the culture becomes elitist. It becomes there's us and then there's them beneath. And then by the 14th century, you have a rising gentry or middle class, almost men who are not aristocracy, are not the great nobles, but who are seeking access to it because they have the wealth to be able to establish themselves with land, and therefore they can aspire to knightly status. And so they incorporate aspects of chivalric behavior and chivalric identity into their characters. So there it starts to expand again. But again, once they're in, they tend to close off what the people below. So they'll kind of shut the doors behind them, as it were, once they get within that chivalric elite. And so the chivalry becomes, again, a sort of a capsule with there's an elite and there's an us and them element. What it means for, in terms of battlefields, is, yeah, there is a quite clear distinction. There are, you know, you will ransom chivalric prisoners, but people below that, they're not worth it. And again, that's practical. They're not worth the money they've got no money to ransom themselves with. So why would you bother taking them prisoner? You've got to look after them. You've got to feed them. You've got to keep them. So it's easier just to let them die, as it were. It's also perhaps an element of that it's easier to take prisoner a man who's wearing lots of armor, because obviously he can survive physical combat better. So armor protects you, even if you're getting beaten to the ground where you have to surrender. At least you're alive long enough to be able to surrender. And for those without that level of armor, perhaps there's not that opportunity in quite the same way. So that might be something to consider as well. But the rules of chivalry do apply outside. So those who are not within combatants necessarily, but those who are non-combatant, those who are unable to defend themselves, there is an element of chivalric behavior that says you should protect the weak, you should protect the innocent. And this is that Christian element of chivalry that kind of feeds in, which acts as a restraint on the sort of pure martial prowess, element of prowess. Again, it's honored as much in the breach as it is anything else. So there are plenty of opportunities of examples, rather, of knights doing the most, what we consider most horrendous things to civilian populations, to non-knightly classes. And there's a tension between the chivalric class and the non-noble in many places. Italy has a very different feel from many other elements of Western Europe in terms of its relationship between its aristocracy and its urban or peasant classes. There's much more antipathy between the two. But generally, the idea is that you should protect the innocent, because that's the right Christian thing to do. But there are clearly, there are clear delineations between the chivalric elite and those who sit outside, particularly when it comes to combatants. Yeah.
I think I found as well, so I did my master's in self-inflicted wounds, and I looked at the history of suicide. And one thing you find is that the medieval world is when they They literally make it like an act that flies in the face of God, which is huge in the medieval times. And yet with the chivalric class, the French historian I was reading that wrote about it was saying that in the Middle Ages, actually, they had an unfair advantage in that if you were suicidal and you were a knight, you just ride into a hopeless cause and no one's ever going to judge you for it. You're not going to be dragged behind a wagon through the town and have all your property inheritance not go to your family and be taken by the state, which I found really interesting.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
I can send you I translated the whole thing into English. I can send it to you because it was actually a really good point. He gave a couple of examples from, I think, the 13th century of these knights where there was no other outcome when they did what they did. There was no sort of altruistic side to it. They weren't protecting the weak. It wasn't to clear a path for others to follow and win the battle. It was just riding to death. And pointing out that actually they would have not been held to the same sort of horrific by today's standards of someone who'd taken their own life.
Yeah, I suppose on the grounds that how were you to, because the narrative is that they were being chivalric, they were showing themselves to be a prude on, that death in battle was honourable and
So there's like a class distinction, isn't it?
That's interesting. Yeah.
I've just sent you down a massive rabbit hole now. I translated the whole book into English. I'll send it to you.
Please do. No, that's a fascinating element I hadn't really considered before.
I'll send you my notes. I didn't get to use it in the end because my supervisor went, Alex, this is a master's and you're being ridiculous. You do not need to go back to the medieval world to talk about guys shooting themselves in the foot on the Somme. But I did just want to kind of bring it up to 20th century and talk about how culturally chivalry's moved on. There is a massive new television series coming in about 3 weeks' time. And it has been coming for years. And it's all about the 8th Air Force in World War II. And it's called Knights of the Air. This is a World War I thing, really, sort of aeroplanes taking on traditional cavalry roles and things. But this whole narrative of Knights of the Air, the chivalric arm and that, is that anything you've ever looked at? Or why? Or is it us cherry picking later on, hundreds of years later, the notion of chivalry that we like the best? And like,
yeah, I did. Funny enough, you were talking about, as soon as you mentioned talking about Knights of the Air, talking about World War One pilots, it took me back to my PhD in bloody banners. I was looking at display on the battlefield, so I was looking at how armor makes you look scary, but also the use of heraldry and banners on the battlefield and what that was all about and why you did it. And there was a really good article on the painting of aeroplanes by World War One pilots as a means of identification, and quite what that identification was about, whether it was about being recognized by your friends and your foes, which is the same sort of debate that goes on with heraldry. It's like heraldry on the battlefield is there to show that you're present, to show that you're taking part. It's not so much there to make sure that you can tell your enemies from your friends. It's actually a display of your and your family's position. And I think there are similarities there in the way in which, particularly when it comes to individualistic combat, which World War One air combat, and I'm off my topic and I'm already kind of second guessing myself here, feels like it is very much an individualistic enterprise as much as it is there being a group, a sort of group dynamic to it as well. And I'm aware that there are both, which actually is true of medieval cavalry combat, medieval chivalric combat too. It is all about being a prude, on being the greatest you can possibly be and being recognized as an individual. But you're also part of a team, part of a retinue, part of a company. And there's a lot of time spent talking about working together and about being ordinate, about being ordered. So those two things work together. Sorry, that's another rabbit hole. Coming back to your question, I think there's an element of continuity. And I also think that there's a cherry picking as well. And there's a use of a sort of modern or Victorian romantic view of chivalry that's also incorporated into that. So continuity first. The continuity comes through because chivalry and chivalric behavior comes into the gentry class in the high and late Middle Ages. So men who are aristocrats, but also men who are sort of upper middle class, who are landholders, incorporate elements of chivalric behavior into it. They become, in the 16th and 17th century, then men who become officers, and officers are also gentlemen, and they take on aspects of chivalric culture. And there's a lot written about the development of chivalry in the 16th and 17th centuries, how it transitions away from being a purely aristocratic elite to something a bit more pragmatic, a bit more workaday. There are examples in the 16th century of English gentry going across and fighting in the wars of religion on the continent, and the Continentals looking at these men who are doing great deeds of chivalric virtue and going, they're a bit out of touch. We don't tend to do that stuff anymore. But it's clear that that chivalric ideal is carried through into the officer class, and that carries through into the professional officer class right the way down through until today. So there's a reason that officers still carry swords. At least in sort of formal terms. It's not because it's a particularly useful weapon, but it's a mark of their status as a gentleman. And that comes through because they are a marshal. That martial elite still underpins the reason that they stand there. So they're there to protect honor. The sword is there as a representation of their honor and status. So all of those things trace themselves right back through to that chivalric underpinning of the medieval knightly class earlier. So I think when it comes to the development of the air corps and the first pilots, military pilots, because they tend to come from the officer class and particularly from the cavalry, then they're already imbued with a sense of chivalric tradition that can somewhat loosely be traced back through to medieval knighthood and medieval chivalry. But they're also very self-conscious about that. So that those traditions have been reinforced because they've looked back and said to themselves, well, we're actually the inheritors of the medieval knightly class because we were cavalrymen, because we're now up in the air and we're jousting with each other. We have, you know, these one-on-one combats, that very personal sense of combat against your opponent. And so you reinforce what's already there by kind of cycling back into it and then picking those bits that strike you as being most, the things that kind of resonate the most with you, which tends to be the sort of more romantic element of the joust, so that one-on-one personal combat, and of that sense about being able to take the surrender of your opponent, showing largesse in terms of allowing them to retire from the field or allowing them to be able to surrender, and treating them as gentlemen, treating them according to their class, according to their status, again, which is a very chivalric thing. So I think, yeah, both of those elements are in there. So yes, there is a tradition that does channel through from the medieval to the modern, but at the same time, those modern warriors are self-conscious of their chivalric status, of the links, and they kind of reinforce the elements that speak to them. And chivalry at the moment there are a number of people who are looking at chivalry again in the 21st century because of the rise, unfortunately, the rise of the outright, particularly in the States, which are utilizing and adopting elements of chivalric and likely medieval culture as they understand it to reinforce their own ideas about modern masculine culture and modern white culture, which again is a whole different way and aspect of looking at chivalry, which has very little, in some ways, very little to do with medieval chivalry, except in a very sort of twisted and cherry-picked version. So I think, yeah, we very often pick elements of the past cultures that sort of speak to us and then make them work for what we want them to, that's why as historians, what we're here to do is actually to go back and look at it and say, well, actually, that's not what it's like. Have another look, see it in the round.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why we do what we do. But Rob, it's been really, really interesting. I mean, we've been going for about an hour, and we've covered chivalry from like the 13th century through to 1945. So thank you very much for coming to speak to us today. And where can people find you on the internet, or have you got any publications that all of our listeners should rapidly go out and buy?
Available in, or actually not so much in all good bookshops. So A Cultural History of the Medieval Sword, Power, Piety and Play. is my latest, is the latest book that's been out just recently. I co-edited a book called The Companion to Chivalry with my old PhD supervisor, Peter Koss, which is a really good introduction, covers, has a number of different historians with much more specialist knowledge of particular aspects of chivalry than me and can kind of fill out what we just scratched the surface of. And Bloody Banners, which was my first book as well. So if you want to look at military display and how it relates, medieval military display and how it relates to animal display, that's in there if you want something slightly different. But you can find me at, well, under historianinharness.com. That's my website. And you'll find me on X and Instagram under pretty much the same things. Under X, I'm on Rob Jones History. So find me there if you're not put off by my ramblings. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, cool. No, thanks. It's been really interesting. We'll have to do it again sometime.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com